Near dark, aboard the Central America off the Carolina coast, Saturday, September 12th, 1857. Captain Herndon told one passenger that he had strong hopes the steamer would survive till daylight, when the storm would lie down and the brig Marine would come to rescue them all. "They will stay by us," he said. "They promised me they would." Herndon retired to his quarters and emerged in full dress uniform. On the wheelhouse, he took his stand, gripping the iron railing with his left hand and striking a pose that seemed inhumanly serene, as though he had reached deep and found a strange peace. He ordered Frazier to remain with him until he went from the ship. They would be the last to leave. Just as Frazier lit the first distress rocket, they saw off the starboard bow the lifeboat of the bosun, John Black. Herndon ordered the men to cut off portions of the upper deck housing and stack them on deck, so they would be scattered about on the surface if the ship sank and men struggled to stay alive in the sea. The thought that had intruded many times into the fear and exhaustion of the past 2 days came sharply into focus during those latter moments, for now they had to decide whether to take the gold or leave it behind. Gold was dense. A Red House brick weighed about 4 pounds. A gold brick of the same size weighed nearly 50. Even in smaller amounts, gold could sink a weak swimmer or quickly exhaust a strong one. As if to dramatize the hysteria of such a dilemma, one man ripped open a bag containing $20,000 in gold dust and sprayed it about the main cabin as though he were a pixie. Others unhitched treasure belts, upended purses, snapped open carpet bags, flinging the shining coins and dust across the floor. "Hundreds of thousands of dollars were thus thrown away," said a passenger. Badger had a satchel filled with 825 $20 double eagle gold pieces fresh from the San Francisco Mint, which he flung onto the floor of the captain's cabin, telling the men to help themselves. But no one did. Amid the shouting and confusion, some men stood topside in a resigned daze and tossed gold coins at the wind. "The scene among the passengers was one of the most indescribable confusion and alarm," said one passenger. "The prayers of the pious and the penitent, the curses of the maddened, and the groans and shrieks of the affrighted were all commingled together, added to which were numerous angry contests for a possession of articles on which to keep themselves afloat in the water." Captain Herndon stood on the hurricane deck next to the wheelhouse, his trumpet in hand. The first officer, second officer Frazier, and Ansel Easton stood with him. At 7:50, the captain and Frazier pulled themselves onto the deck above the wheelhouse and fired 3 rockets downward into the waves, a maritime distress signal to the schooner and the brig that the ship now was sinking rapidly. Easton had secured neither a life preserver nor a plank to float upon, but as he was standing with the captain, his friend, Robert Brown, came up with one of the superior cork life preservers and handed it to him. Brown had already donned one. As soon as Easton snapped the life preserver tight, the captain turned to him and said, "Give me your cigar, Easton, for this last rocket." And as Easton took the cigar from his mouth and handed it to the captain, a huge sea slammed into the ship. Then another heavy sea hit and made her pitch astern. Frazier saw a rocket go off horizontally, straight out over the ocean. An old miner yelled, "My God, we shall all perish!" And in a flash of lightning, one passenger later swore he saw the entire deck and Captain Herndon standing upon the wheelhouse, his hat in hand, and within seconds a third and monstrous sea crashed across the deck of the Central America, sweeping her deck of nearly everything and everyone. The stern sank below the waves, and then as the hoarse screams of 500 men rose, she began a slow, watery spin, the water turning faster and faster and faster until the swirling vortex sucked the men into a suffocating darkness with the once majestic steamer. Others shot up through black water, and suddenly rocketing upward from deep in the sea came the spars, the hatch covers, the stateroom doors that fell back with a heavy crash to kill many of those who had survived being sucked into the whirlpool. Many struggled in the water with bruised or broken limbs. From everywhere shrieks for help pierced the wind, but the calls for help quickly began to subside. In 10 minutes, said Thomas Badger, 300 had sunk to rise no more. At each successive flash of lightning, the men discovered fewer of their comrades around them, until most found themselves drifting in the dark on a slender plank, alone amid the fury of a vast and indifferent sea. The men and the flotsam soon scattered across the ocean for a mile. About an hour after the ship sank, some of the men saw a light to leeward, that of the schooner El Dorado, but they knew that a ship to the lee could be of no help. They turned and searched the darkness, facing into the wind, because if help were to come, it would come from that direction. "I have no words to describe the melancholy scene," Dr. Obed Harvey reported later. "Soon after I had got to sea, I secured a small door. This was of great service to me. I saw many perish, and was frequently drawn under the water by drowning men. The waves ran high and frequently dashed over us." Dr. Harvey had been in the water for 5 hours alone when a man floated up alongside of him in a chair. The man was exhausted and placed his hand upon Dr. Harvey's floating door. At first, Dr. Harvey hesitated to aid, fearing that the door would not support both of them. The man said his name was Frazier, and that if he were lost at sea, he would leave a young family in New York destitute. Dr. Harvey then recognized the young man Frazier as the second officer of the Central America. "I told him to let his chair go and share with me on my floating substance, and that we would sink or survive together." In the hold of the Marine, hogsheads of molasses had burst and the molasses had run loose, sending thick, noxious odors wafting upward into the cabin, a room scarcely larger than an ordinary stateroom on the steamer. No more, estimated one woman, than 8 feet square. Yet many of the 31 women and all of the 26 children huddled there. For Addie Easton and another woman who chose to bed down on the deck, Captain Burt spread a piece of sail across the hatch cover for them to lie on, and then covered them with canvas. But Addie could not close her eyes without seeing and hearing the struggles of the drowning. "I reproached myself," she later wrote, "that I had not stayed to share my dear one's fate." When the captain was not on duty, he would prop himself on his elbows next to her and try to quiet her fears for her husband. "The captain's kindness I can never forget," she continued. "He told us of many wonderful rescues he had known, and ended with the cheering words, 'Something tells me you will meet your husbands when we get in port.'" Late that night, with the sea still high but the wind beginning to drop, Captain Burt slowly worked the Marine back and forth, edging north to where the steamer had suddenly disappeared. But they saw no survivors and no wreckage, only the light of a schooner several miles distant. Dawn brought light to a clearer sky and revealed a sea now rounded and rolling. Captain Burt raised more sail, searching in the vicinity for hours. They saw not a trace of the carnage. About 2 p.m., he made all the sail he could and bore up for Norfolk. Columbus, Ohio, 1981. Battelle Memorial Institute opened its doors in 1929, a privately funded, not-for-profit facility for the making of discoveries and inventions. Battelle scientists developed the insulating tiles that protect NASA space vehicles from incinerating when they re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. Battelle headquarters, and home to 3,000 scientists and engineers, was in Columbus, just south of the Ohio State campus. Don Frink headed Battelle's equipment development section, 60% of whose research and development was for the government. "Our group does oddball things," said Frink, "in space or underground or behind enemy lines or underwater. A large portion of the work is ocean engineering, which is even more unique than standard contract research. Each year, out of 200 applications from top engineering graduates across the country, Frink would give offers to 5. In the spring of 1981, Tommy arranged an audience with Don Frink, and Frink thought the young man fit his formula for new engineers. Swan, he called it. Smart, willing to work hard, ambitious, nice to work with. Frink called Tommy's professors at Ohio State, and they all confirmed that Tommy fit the Swan formula. A week after their first meeting, Tommy called again and set up another interview, and this time Frink invited 4 of his engineers. One was Don Hackman, the world's foremost expert in underwater tooling. Frink's biggest worry was, "Do I have 100% of Tommy?" "Your subconscious has got to be working for Battelle," said Frink. Later he admitted, "I got more out of Tommy than I thought. 4 years, 5 years, he stayed here." As Frink worried over how much of Tommy's brain would be engaged on Battelle matters and what portion might wander elsewhere, One thought never occurred to him, that before long he and Don Hackman both would be working for Tommy. In one of his frequent trips from Key West back to Columbus, Tommy had met an eclectic fellow named Bob Evans, a university student majoring in geology. Bob was trained and accomplished as a classical pianist, soon to be a jazz pianist and a collector of odd bits of information. He seemed to remember everything he had ever read, and his mind made so many connections so quickly that listening to him talk was like watching time-lapse photography. He also was good-natured and unpretentious. Bob and his wife lived on one side of an old Victorian double near campus. He had graduated from Ohio State with his degree in geology and was consulting for the oil industry in Ohio. Bob loved to talk. He could get so cranked up his shoulder-length blonde hair would bounce and his droopy mustache would jiggle. He and Tommy would sit on Bob's front porch and talk about crazy things like diamond mines in Canada and treasure troves buried by Indians. Tommy told Bob there were places in the middle of the Caribbean where hundreds of old shipwrecks lay stacked on top of each other. That was one of the problems. How do you tell the wreck you're looking for from all the other wrecks? And how do you know, he asked Bob, that the wreck you're looking for hasn't already been salvaged anyhow? Treasure hunters would research the king's records in the Spanish archives, find nothing about a salvage, and assume the treasure was still at the wreck site. But not everybody reported everything to the king. Treasure hunters were subject to too many whims of weather, of history, of government, of human nature, and that is why almost all of them failed. To succeed, they needed more control. They needed to analyze and reduce their risk. The treasure was there. During the 3 centuries following Columbus's voyages to the New World, much of the gold and silver on Earth had been transferred from the New World to the Old World, and 25% of it had been lost. But don't search for it among the thousands of shallow water wrecks in the Caribbean, said Tommy. The odds were too slim. Search for treasure where storms couldn't buffet the remains, where ships were not piled on top of each other, where the bottom was hard and the current slow, and where no government could stake a claim. Tommy told Bob he wanted to recover historic shipwrecks in the deep ocean. In the mornings, Tommy reported to the equipment development section at Battelle, where Don Frink quickly saw a side of him he had not guessed was there. His ability to impress sophisticated clients, like the supervisor of salvage in Washington, D.C., who was in charge of creating and developing dive and salvage equipment for the Navy. The government appeared ready to spend huge sums on deep ocean mineral recovery, so Frink assigned Tommy to work on the concept of mining the deep ocean. Tommy put in more hours than anyone at Battelle, trying to create a system that made sense economically and environmentally. But at night he continued thinking about ships lost in the deep ocean. Although the value of minerals would have to rise dramatically to warrant the cost of developing the technology to mine the deep ocean, a single ship with a large payload might be enough to convince investors to give him the money he would need to create the technology that could penetrate the deep ocean barrier. The first technology for working on the bottom of the ocean had come in the 17th century, when Sir Edmund Halley, discoverer of the comet, created a diving bell with glass viewing ports. 3 men could remain inside at 60 feet for an hour and 45 minutes, and they could salvage the armament of a ship sunk in the harbor by securing it with ropes and chains and letting another crew haul it to the surface with ship's tackle. After 1963, when the nuclear submarine Thresher had sunk in over 8,000 feet of water, leaving her crew with no hope of rescue, the Navy had begun designing and building an array of underwater vehicles. Deep submergence rescue vehicles could descend to 6,500 feet, clamp onto a downed submarine, take on the trapped submariners, and transfer them to the surface. The Navy built 2 DSRVs for $220 million in the early 1970s. During the Cold War, funding for these deep water submersibles came from the intelligence community. The most notable was the 1974 ultra-secret Glomar Explorer, a 600-foot ship created under the ruse of a Howard Hughes attempt to mine the deep ocean, but with really only one mission, to send a giant mechanical claw into 20,000 feet of water and pick up the hull of a downed Soviet submarine. In raising the nearly 200-foot section of hull to the surface, the claw cracked and most of the section was lost. The project cost $500 million. 20 years after the Thresher went down, we had submersibles that could dive much deeper and stay much longer than Halley's diving bell. They had recovered spent torpedoes and missiles, explored manganese deposits, studied geology, and inspected offshore drilling rigs. But if you stripped away the computerized guidance systems, the propulsion systems, the fresh air recyclers, the hydraulics, the new acrylics and seals, the sonar and the cameras, these new submersibles could do little more than attach grappling hooks to objects and let a crew topside winch them to the surface, or grasp something in an awkward claw and hold on. Almost any ocean engineer who wanted to recover an old shipwreck in deep water could drop a steam shovel clam bucket on the wreck site and indiscriminately munch up the wreck. But things would break. The archaeological value would be destroyed. Tommy wanted to explore and document a wreck, then dismantle it, moving one piece without disturbing another, and he wanted to film and photograph it. He envisioned an automated machine shop that he could operate from thousands of feet above, the ultimate Swiss Army knife of underwater technology, a tool for everything with but a flick of the topside wrist, saws, grabbers, backhoes, drills, blowers, pickers, cameras, and light booms. Robots were the answer. The oil industry was starting to use them to replace divers, and the military had used them underwater for years. In 1982, only 10 existed, and they still presented problems. But those were problems Tommy now thought he could solve, because the secret to working in the deep ocean was not in the technology, where everyone else had been looking. Most of the technological pieces were there. They just hadn't been put together properly. Before he could do anything on the bottom, Tommy first had to find the shipwreck. In 1977, engineers working for the mining consortium that had surveyed the deep ocean had also developed a vacuum that could suck up potato-sized nodules of manganese from the fields that they imaged. After dragging their vacuum along the ocean floor, the techs had returned for a second look with their imaging system, and they had seen a little white band in the middle of the manganese field. A stripe created by the vacuum sucking up the nodules. The water there was 18,000 feet deep, and that white stripe was only 6 feet wide. 3 years later, Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Geological Institute had received funds from a benefactor to build the Seamark 1, a sonar prototype. Lamont Doherty wanted the sonar to survey underwater mountain ranges and other geological formations in deep water. Tommy understood the technology, and he thought that with some adjustments, he could use it to find shipwrecks in the deep ocean. But Tommy also discovered that since Lamont Doherty was a public institution, any information on deep water shipwrecks he collected while using the Seamark automatically entered the public domain. In 5 years of traveling and talking on the phone, Tommy had built a large and diverse network of scientists and engineers and oceanographers. In 1983, one of these contacts introduced him to Mike Williamson, the geophysicist who had sailed with the Mining Consortium tech team to find manganese. Williamson still remembered the day 6 years earlier when they had seen that thin white stripe cutting through a manganese field. He couldn't believe they could image something that small, that deep, and they could do it in swaths 3 miles wide. You could really start hurting up the real estate, thought Williamson. If he had one of those imaging systems, he could quickly search large areas of deep ocean for downed aircraft, flight recorders, bombs, missile parts, and finer geology for the oil companies. The only thing holding him back was the $1 million price tag. By 1983, Williamson had started an ocean technology company, and he still wanted that $1 million sonar. About this time, Tommy called him and encouraged him to go ahead with the project, even to the point of helping him find financing. Tommy wanted to use it to find deep water shipwrecks. Tommy now allocated more and more of his free hours each month to studying ships that had sunk in deep water, like the Titanic, the Republic, the Andrea Doria, and the San Jose. For each ship, he wanted to know, was there enough historical documentation to determine that the ship carried a cargo of substantial value when it sank, and that the ship sank in a roughly definable location? If the answer to these questions was yes, he then studied the ocean environment at that location. If the ocean floor was deep sediment, the wreck would be buried and the sediment would fill in the wreck site faster than he could dig it out. If the currents ran swift, he would not be able to study the site carefully and later position a robot with cameras. One of the ships he researched was a sidewheel steamer called the SS Central America. For years, the story had persisted that the wreck of the Central America lay off Cape Hatteras, 100 feet deep. Treasure hunters with no more than scuba tanks and hookah rigs found it a convenient legend to keep alive, because if that legend died, so did their source of funding. But Tommy had read many of the newspaper articles written in 1857, then plotted the information from one officer's account and estimated that the ship had foundered at a coordinate roughly 100 miles east and north of Cape Romaine on the Carolina coast. One evening, after work, he stopped by Bob's house. If the wreck of this sidewheel steamer lay 100 miles from Cape Romaine, it would be in the middle of the geographical feature called the Blake Ridge. Tommy wanted to know what the bottom was like out there. Bob didn't know the answer, but he told Tommy he would find out what he could at the geology library on campus. What Bob read about the Blake Ridge so excited him, he called Tommy at work, and the two of them met at Bob's house that night. "Harvey, this is not a problem at all," he said. On the Blake Ridge, currents moved by at 1/10 of a knot, and for miles the bottom was hard sediment. Bob told Tommy, "I mean the sediment collects out there at no more than 1 centimeter every 1,000 years. Tommy and Bob met more frequently, together refining what they called the historic shipwreck selection process and narrowing the targets to a project Tommy could present to investors. They divided risk into intrinsic and extrinsic. Intrinsic risks were those inherent to the site: probability of previous salvage, accuracy of historical documentation, and the environment around the wreck. Next, they assessed the extrinsic risks, those that had to do with recovery. Is the technology available to access that site? Can we guarantee site security in that area of the world? And do we have legal protection? Each wreck had to pass a final test. Was there anything on board worth recovering? The Titanic was a hunk of steel 700 feet long that would burn a hole through a sonar chart, and the abundant historical documentation would help them narrow the search area. But the Titanic presented two insurmountable risks. Her steel hull would be impossible to penetrate even with the technology Tommy saw on the horizon. And if they could get inside, she carried nothing worth recovering. No treasure centrally stored, nothing they could use to make the payoff attractive to investors. In terms of risk, said Bob, the Titanic was not a good project. Other deep water wrecks presented similar problems. Myths had arisen around some of them that tons of gold lay stored in secure compartments, but no historical data supported the myths. The Andrea Doria, an Italian liner, collided with another ship in dense fog in 1956 and went down just off Nantucket. Her passengers were wealthy, but myth about the treasure on board sprouted from rumor with no documentation. They were convinced that the San Jose had carried more than $1 billion in treasure to the bottom when British warships sank her in 1708. But the San Jose was off the coast of Colombia in murky, turbulent waters. After running many deep water shipwrecks through the selection process, the sidewheel steamer SS Central America rose to the top in every category. It had sunk at an era of accurate record-keeping and reliable navigation instruments. She had a wooden hull, which would be easier to get into, and her steam engines and boilers would provide a good target for sonar. And it was off the coast of the United States, so they wouldn't have to negotiate with a foreign government. And her gold shipment was documented. The publicly reported commercial shipment totaled between $1.210 and $1.6 million. Some accounts estimated that the gold carried by the passengers at least equaled the commercial shipment, and the Department of the Army had recently confirmed a story that had circulated for years, that the Central America carried an official secret shipment of gold destined to shore up the faltering northern industrial economy. The letter, dated April 2, 1971, verified that secreted in her hold, the Central America had also carried 650-pound bar boxes, or another 30,000 pounds of gold. In his historical research, Tommy had uncovered two coordinates that helped pinpoint the sinking. One came from the Ellen, a bark that had sailed into the wreckage the following day, and the other came from the El Dorado, the schooner that had rounded the stern within a cracker's throw of the Central America only 90 minutes before she sank. The only problem was that the El Dorado coordinate approximated the site of the sinking, and the Ellen coordinate marked the area to where the wreckage had drifted over the next 12 hours. But the two positions were nearly 60 miles apart, and the wreckage could not have drifted that far in that time, even in the Gulf Stream. The search area would be too big, unless Tommy could find another coordinate to confirm either the coordinate of the El Dorado or the coordinate of the Ellen. In collecting newspaper articles, Tommy had discovered that on the day after the sinking, the Ellen had spoke another ship, the Saxony, bound for Savannah. Just on gut instinct, I thought, God, somebody, some reporter somewhere must have found out where the Saxony was and got those coordinates. Tommy called Savannah's CEL Regional Library and found a librarian willing to do the research. A few days later, Tommy received a letter dated October 18, 1983. Dear Mr. Thompson, your perseverance has been rewarded. Enclosed is the entire entry. It was an obscure notice in the shipping register of the Savannah Daily Morning News. The coordinate, latitude 3140, longitude 7620, which meant that the Saxony had spoke the Ellen no more than 15 miles from where the Ellen captain reported that he had been tacking through the wreckage earlier that day. Now we had a third coordinate from the day after the disaster that was in the same area of the ocean, said Bob. It gave the Ellen coordinate credence, and the existence of those two coordinates within the ballpark of each other was enough to convince us we've got something scientific to play with now. It's not just hearsay. But he still couldn't explain why those two coordinates were 60 miles from the El Dorados. Tommy now had acquired dozens of survivors' accounts and other documents. He had even created a matrix, breaking the sinking into time segments, so he could understand the chronology of events. But studying technology was requiring more and more of his time, and he also had to pursue financing. So he gave Bob all the articles and letters and asked Bob to take over as historian. He was a real trivia freak, said Tommy, which is perfect for a project like this. By the fall of 1983, Bob's geology consulting practice had dwindled anyhow. The oil industry was pulling in, drying up. Bob put it euphemistically, I had more time on my hands. The sinking of the Central America was one of the biggest news events of 19th century America. It was the worst disaster in American shipping, and several pundits of the day attributed the panic of 1857 largely to the loss of the gold shipment aboard the steamer. As survivors returned to their hometowns, the story lived for months in over 200 newspapers. 2 or 3 days a week, several hours a day, Bob sat scanning the white-on-black film of articles from old newspapers. Frank Leslie's Illustrated, the New York News, the New York Times, and the New York Journal of Commerce. Before long, Bob could recite from memory long passages of the survivors' accounts. The matrix became the data correlation matrix, and it soon expanded to take up one entire wall, floor to ceiling, in the study of Bob's house. In 1979, Tommy had received a phone call from a lawyer practicing in a small Columbus firm. Robbie Hoffman, a short, funny, friendly, fast-talking man not much older than Tommy, had a client interested in salvaging the Andrea Doria. Tommy had told Robbie that the Andrea Doria was a poor target. Robbie dropped the client, but he liked working with Tommy. Tommy and Robbie had talked then about deep ocean recovery one day being a viable business. When it happens and you're doing it, Robbie had said, you call me because I want to be involved. By 1983, Robbie had left his firm and gone out on his own. Tommy was now convinced that one day was here. He called Robbie and reminded him of what he had said 4 years earlier. Before long, Tommy was at Robbie's house 2 or 3 nights a week working on the project. He seemed not to notice the indiscretion of showing up nigh on to midnight, night after night, at the home of a newly married friend. Robbie thought it was outrageous, but he accepted the behavior. Harvey was so driven that it made it difficult at times to put up with him, said Robbie. But that's the nature of the beast being the brilliant person. You have to be able to accept a lot about them. With Robbie's new wife often asleep in the bedroom, Tommy and Robbie worked drafting letters to research libraries, suppliers, contractors, and potential investors. Tommy had already discussed financing with his old mentor, Dean Glauer. Glauer was now dean of all 15 engineering departments at Ohio State's College of Engineering. One day in early 1984, Tommy had called Glauer and said, "I think I found our ship." He made an appointment to meet with Glauer at the dean's office. Glauer listened, then called the office of Herb Laip, 50 feet down the hall. "Herb," he said, "come up here a second. I want you to hear a story." Herb Laip was in charge of fundraising for the College of Engineering. He had connections Glauer didn't have. He had grown up in a Columbus suburb called Bexley, home to the community's ultra-wealthy. Laip thought, "My God, I've got to get some friends of mine to listen to this. This is the biggest crapshoot I've ever heard of." Glauer suggested that Laip set up a luncheon. Prior to the luncheon, Laip had told Tommy that Wayne Ashby would be the key man there. He was the managing partner of 150 CPAs in the Columbus office of the national accounting firm of Deloitte, Haskins, and Sells. He or his firm did the books and the tax work for just about everybody in the room and a whole lot of other people in the Columbus area. He knew virtually everybody who might be interested in a deal like the one Tommy proposed. Ashby sat through the whole presentation, which lasted an hour, and left only a little more than intrigued. "I'm sure we all thought it was interesting and informative, and that was the end of it." Tommy waited for 2 weeks before he called Ashby. He kept the conversation informative and slightly inquisitive, but his approach, no matter how professional, could not change one thing. "I just didn't have much time for him," said Ashby. Tommy closed by saying he would call again in 2 weeks to give Ashby another update, and then he did. Whenever they spoke, Tommy always closed the conversation by saying he would call back in a week or 2 weeks or a month, and as busy as he was, Ashby always said that would be fine. Though he had little time to think about it, what Ashby had locked on back at the investors' luncheon, and the tiny spark he could just not extinguish, was the ratio of risk to reward inherent in what Tommy proposed. It was a long shot, it would probably never happen, but if it did, look at the payoff. You could realize your investment 100 times, a 10,000% return. It was a bet you could not ordinarily make anywhere, said Ashby. On the phone one day, he told Tommy, "We've been talking about this for a long time, and I'm to the point where I feel I have to decide whether I'm in this project or out of this project, and I want to think about it." A few days later, he called Tommy back, and he said, "I want to be in this project. What can we do?" By now it was early summer of 1984. As much as he loved Battelle, Tommy's thoughts were elsewhere. Tommy made an appointment with Don Frink and explained to him that he had a project he had been pursuing outside Battelle. He told Frink he wanted to go on a partial leave without pay. Wayne Ashby told Tommy that the first thing they had to do was to get a big downtown law firm involved. To raise a large sum of money from investors in a public offering, Tommy would have to comply with strict regulations from the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Ohio Securities Division. Robbie Hoffman had gotten Tommy this far, but if people of the caliber Ashby wanted to pursue were going to invest, Tommy needed a name these people knew. One of the prominent lawyers in Columbus was Art Voorhees of Voorhees, Sater, Seymour, and Pease, a firm of 265 lawyers. Voorhees had attended the investors' luncheon with Wayne Ashby. When Ashby called a few months later, he agreed to assemble some of his venture capital lawyers in one of the firm's conference rooms. Tommy's presentation went well until Voorhees asked, "How far down is this?" "Well," said Tommy, "it's at least 8,000 feet. Voorhees' jaw dropped. 8,000 feet! He thought about the time he had scuba dived in the Bahamas and blew out both eardrums at 30 feet. "What has ever been done at 8,000 feet? "Nothing," said Tommy. "That's when he lost me," Voorhees said later. One of the CPAs Ashby had brought to the Voorhees meeting was Fred Dauterman, a tax partner at Deloitte for 25 years. When Deloitte clients wanted to put their money into tax-sheltered investments, Ashby brought the deal to Dauterman. After the meeting, he and Ashby went back to Ashby's office. "Ashby," said Dauterman, "this is the craziest deal I've ever heard in the world, but it's crazy enough that it might have something to it." Ashby now went to another big firm in town, Porter, Wright, Morris, and Arthur, specifically to Bill Arthur. Around Columbus, Arthur was known as Mr. Venture Capital, A lawyer who had syndicated real estate deals and oil and gas exploration and myriad startups. He had heard more crazy pitches than anyone else in the city, so Tommy's proposal was not out of the ordinary. What was out of the ordinary was that Wayne Ashby had made the call, and that got Arthur excited about the deal before he even met Tommy. "Here's this absolutely flabbergasting experience," said Arthur. "Wayne Ashby having people buy equity interests in one of these high-risk deals? Wayne is an accountant. He's never promoted anything in his life. He's never even hinted that somebody might invest in something he might know about." When Ashby brought Tommy over to meet Arthur, Arthur didn't even grill him. He didn't need to. His firm represented Battelle, and he thought of the Institute as a bunch of crazies up there doing all kinds of wonderful and exciting things. "With a guy like that," said Arthur, "coupled with the thrill of finding 100 times your money, why in the hell wouldn't you?" Arthur told Ashby, hell yes, his firm would structure the deal, and he turned the project over to one of his younger partners, Kurt Loveland. Loveland brought in another colleague, Bill Kelly, to help him. Tommy, the CPAs, and the lawyers now got together and tried to structure the idea. The meetings ran through the winter and into the spring of 1985. They set up the funding in 3 phases, the seed phase, the search phase, and the recovery phase. To the seed phase, they allocated 10% of the partnership, 20 units at $10,000 per unit, trying to raise $200,000, so Tommy could organize, line up contractors, complete the research, reimburse himself for past expenses, and cover the expenses of trying to raise funds for the next phase. It would give Tommy a chance to show his investors that he not only was scientifically capable, but that he also could manage a company and use their money wisely. For the search phase, they allocated 25% of the partnership, 50 units at $28,000 per unit, to raise $1.4 million to complete a probability map and a search map to mobilize a ship, rent the Seamark 1A that Mike Williamson had just built, and pay him and his tech crew for 40 to 60 days at sea. Search about 1,400 square miles of ocean, find targets that could be the Central America, and verify that one of them was the ship of gold. In the final phase, they would send a robot to the bottom of the ocean to study the site and recover the treasure. And for this, they allocated another 25% of the partnership, 50 units at $72,000 per unit, to raise $3.6 million. That totaled 60% of the project. The remaining 40% went to Tommy and his associates.